I may as well make a start. As Mike's just observed, yes, it's Friday the 13th, which kind of gave me the idea of talking about superstitions. And then I thought it was funny that Freddie just said touch wood, because I was going to make a joke about how touch wood socialists didn't have any superstitions. Anyway.
That'll teach me now then, won't it?
Well, anyway, I thought, but the more I thought about it, I thought, well, actually, there are aspects of superstitions that are kind of, if you like, systemic. And what I mean is there are kind of irrational superstitions that actually capitalist society kind of inculcates in us. So I'm not talking about walking under ladders or, you know, people believing in, you know, sort of ghosts and things. I was more interested in the sort of ritualistic superstitions that, you know, society likes us to have. So, for example, and I think of it as a superstition, this idea of original sin or the sinful nature of humans, which, you know, I mean, the idea of this is to keep us convinced that we need a strong state. We need a coercive state to keep us under control, you know, because we're basically, you know, sinful, bad people. And the reason I call that a superstition rather than just a, you know, like a mistaken belief or just a prejudice is because it feels sort of deeper than that. It feels like a kind of, you know, an emotional level. It feels like a kind of glitch, you know, that's buried like a tick in our psyche, something that sort of, you know, feeds on a primal fear of chaos and disorder. So it's very, very deep rooted. But I mean, whether you call it a superstition or just a, you know, a delusion or whatever, I mean, it doesn't matter. The point is that our rulers are very good at exploiting it. And this led me to further thoughts about other things that they're good at exploiting. And one thing that they like to do is they like to sort of bedazzle us and confound us with the external trappings of power, all the paraphernalia that goes with that, whether it's state power or royal or legal or just kind of, you know, ritualistic institutions. A philosopher called Pascal, who had a computer language named after him, Blaise Pascal, and he had this idea of something that he called the grimace, la grimace. When in France, if you make a grimace, it means to pull a face. And his idea was that this is what the ruling class did. They pulled faces all the time. In other words, they like to distort the outward appearance of things for effect, but most usually in order to overawe us and intimidate ordinary people. So, for instance, he said, you know, this is why lawyers and barristers in courts would wear ridiculously archaic clothing. I mean, in the UK, even today, barristers wear these sort of absurd 18th century gowns and white wigs. And policemen still wear helmets that derive from the time of the Crimean War. Guards at Buckingham Palace wear swords and armour. Mayors wear big gold chains. And there's lots of ritual around the Parliament, the House of Commons. The Speaker has to sits on a woolsack. And since Plantagenet days, Blackrod opens Parliament by banging on the door three times with a big stick. Now, people like rituals. I think they see them as kind of harmless cultural artifacts, historical eccentricities that, you know, kind of go towards the that unique hallmark of the supposedly national character. But I think there's a dark side to ritual. And people don't appreciate this. They don't appreciate the power of ritual to legitimise rule. and the power of ritual to instill obedience as a kind of Pavlovian response. Because ritual is a great weapon used against the working class. And the older it is, the better. because it intimidates us with this sense of inescapable fate. It reinforces a sense of the impossibility of change. It helps to psychologize and medicalize the urge to protest and rebel. And it does all that without the least need to explain or justify itself, no matter how objectively preposterous it might be. Even at the most trivial level, like having to wear a piece of obsolete clothing when working in an office. When you consent to ritual, you're ritualizing consent. You're saying, I agree to this nonsense, therefore I will agree to all your other stupid rules too. And that's why I think it's actually worth resisting these rituals if you can, even if they are trivial. To give one example, in my last job, on the first day, I was told that I was supposed to wear a tie in the office. Now, the thing was, I had a bit of an issue with that. The last time I'd worn a business suit and a tie had been 20 years beforehand, and when I left that job, I happily stuffed my business suit full of newspaper and burned it on a bonfire for Guy Fawkes Night, vowing never to wear one again. So you can imagine my feelings when, in the new job, it was announced that I was expected to wear a tie. This was apparently a general rule for men, except for one guy who was an independent contractor who had concocted some bullshit argument about not being able to wear a tie for health reasons. And I thought, that's ridiculous. I'm just going to say I'm not going to wear one. So I determined to start as I meant to go on, and I reasoned that day one was probably my best bargaining position because I hadn't had time to prove how useless I was yet. So I marched into the boss's office and announced that I'd never agreed to wear a tie and that I hadn't worn a tie at my interview either, and that he had still hired me. Au naturel, so to speak. I also argued that if open-neck shirts were good enough for the bosses of Google, Apple and Tesla, then they were probably good enough for a small regional office in the north of England. Now, you might think I overreacted, and certainly I think the boss was a little stunned that I was making such an issue out of it. But he couldn't actually think of a convincing response to all of these arguments, so he kind of surrendered and gave way in what was regarded by the shocked office veterans as a minor revolution. And subsequently, other men in the office also followed suit and stopped wearing ties. And even the boss himself, I noticed later, stopped wearing a tie. So that was quite funny. Now, ritual, by definition, presupposes continuity. And continuity is the grand narrative of the conservative mind. But reality quite often doesn't play ball. And in particular, the last 2 years have really buggered up the ritualistic operations of capitalism. The pandemic has acted like a disruptive technology, ripping up established working practices and forcing people to adopt new approaches and techniques, just like we've done with the teleconferencing technology we're using right now. And what specifically went out of the window wasn't just ties and high heels, but the requirement to be present in the workplace at all in order to do your work. I mean, 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, the idea of working remotely was a non-starter. It wasn't even conceivable. 10 years ago, it was perfectly possible, but it was still inconceivable from the boss's point of view. To give another example, some time, quite a long time, after my victory over the tie affair, I decided to ask the boss if I could work from home at least part of the time. I thought I had good arguments. I said, it didn't matter where I was as long as I did the work and hit my deadlines, and that after all, I would get more work done if I wasn't constantly surrounded by people coming and going behind the desk and having water cooler discussions about football and, you know, celeb gossip right next to my desk and all this sort of thing. Well, his response was, yes, but what if I need you in a meeting? Okay, I said. I pointed out that he never actually needed me in a meeting, and even if he did, I only lived 10 minutes walk away, so all he had to do was make a phone call and I could come in. But even though he didn't really have an argument, he wouldn't give way on this one. And I think I know the real reason. In his mind, out of sight meant out of control. I might have won the fight over the cloth tie, but he wasn't going to cut the physical tie to the office. Because bosses can be irrational too. As witness, all the hoo-ha we've been hearing about lately, about government trying to wean, and not only government, but banks and all sorts of industry, trying to wean workers off of home working and get them back into workplaces. Just lately, we've seen Jacob Rees-Mogg, or Lord Snooty, as I call him, leaving sarcastic notes for Home Office staff for not being at their office desk, which has properly pissed off the senior civil servants. And we've seen passport office workers being accused of slacking because of a huge seasonal backlog of passports, even though the passport office workers have said that homework has got nothing to do with it. The reason is a sudden rush of applications after 2 years of lockdowns, plus they're understaffed. And by the way, the bad feeling between the government and the civil service looks set to turn into go on to practically a war footing as of today's news, where Boris has announced the intention to cut civil service jobs by 91,000 to save money. No doubt using the argument that they're all skiving at home work, pretending to work anyway, so we can afford to sack them. It makes me wonder if today's Tories are at all familiar with that favourite 1980s comedy Yes Minister. Margaret Thatcher once said that show taught her everything worth knowing about parliamentary politics. Now, actors say that there are two people you should never piss off on a film shoot, one being the makeup artist and the other being the caterer. Well, Yes Minister made it pretty obvious that it's a very brave or reckless politician who dares to piss off their Whitehall support staff. But Tories just love being contemptuous of workers, just like Jacob Rees-Mogg, just like that obnoxious MP the other day who blamed the poor for not being able to cook, and then announced that it was perfectly possible to cook a meal for 30p, which is a feat I would like to see him perform. And of course, the Tories have got their cheerleaders in business too. Just think about that loudmouthed Alan Sugar, who just the other day slagged off PricewaterhouseCoopers staff as lazy gits because they were allowed to go home Friday lunchtime if they'd done their week's work. If they'd done their work, they could go home at lunchtime. He called them lazy gits. This prompted PwC executives to describe him as, quote, out of touch. I'm not sure about you, but I think I can think of some pretty more colourful descriptions than that for Alan Sugar. And also, many business owners have realised that there are upsides to letting people work from home. I mean, you know, they don't have to pay for office space or equipment or heating or lighting or car parking. They don't have to provide toilets or lunch hours or water coolers. They don't need to worry about employers' liability or legal limits on hours worked. They can forget all about health and safety in the workplace. And they surely must be aware that actually it's more difficult to skive off at home if you've got a deadline than if you're just in the office pretending to work, which is known as presenteeism. I used to be a terrible example of this myself. I've no sense of working class integrity. I once spent an entire 3 months behind a desk in an office doing nothing but playing a computer game. Prince of Persia it was. I got all the way to the end level and married the princess. And why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't I skive? I thought I wasn't doing any important or worthwhile job that benefited humanity. It's not like I was a doctor or a paramedic or something. I was just helping some company get a bit richer. So I took a class war view of it. The bosses want to screw me, as much work out of me for as little money as they can get to pay. So logically, I should just do the exact opposite. So, like I say, unless you're working on life-saving vaccines or something, or you're doing something useful for people, which a lot of workers are not, just skive if you can. Why not? And, of course, bosses know that that's how workers think. They know that workers skive, and they think they can prevent skiving if the workers are actually physically in the office where they can see them. Well, they're completely wrong about that, as I think I've just demonstrated. Workers can show real ingenuity and flair and artistry in finding ways to skive, even under the boss's very nose. So bosses are very often kidding themselves if they think they really know what's going on in the office. You know, and it can be anything from taking five minute extra tea breaks, or having fag breaks, even when you don't smoke, every hour, or 15-minute toilet breaks, or just inflating expense claims, or even robbing stuff out of the stationery cupboard. I mean, why not? The bosses take our whole lives off us for their profit. The least we can do is rob a stapler. But now, this is a thing, this is my point, we found a way to rob them of our physical presence too. And they bloody hate that. They hate the idea that not only they can't see us, but we can't see them. We can't see them patrolling around the office in their suits and ties and their grimace, because we're not there to be bowed and cowed by their performance. It confronts all their control freakery. They see it as subversion. They see it as something that's chewing away at the fabric of the social order. And just the other day, there was some fuss because the new employment bill was left out of the Queen's speech that was actually Prince Charles that made the Queen's speech. But anyway, the employment bill was left out of this, probably because it was going to enshrine aspects of homeworking into employment law. What my understanding of this is now, if I had gone to a boss and said, I want to work from home, I can work from home, it's perfectly feasible, the boss would actually be obliged to let me do it. well, okay. Well, I think if this is what workers want, and why wouldn't they? Because I would. They should fight for this if they want to improve their working conditions, because, you know, despite there is an onus being put on them to pay for their own equipment, you know, pay for their own heating and lighting and stuff like that. There is a slight downside in that respect, but they can claim part of that back in tax, but more to the point, that, you know, they should defend a power to not have to put up with a boss leaning over their shoulder and breathing down their neck. They should be able to work when they want instead of when some boss expects them to. I mean, this is the era of catch-up on-demand TV. So it's about time we had catch-up on-demand working conditions to go with it. Now, I mean, none of this changes the obvious fundamental fact that as a worker, you're always going to be exploited to make a profit for someone else. But the conditions of that exploitation also matter. Really, homework is about severing the emotional and the psychological handcuffs that workplace culture and those lurking bosses place on workers to lock them into obedience. And it's about discovering that, you know, even though you're still a wage slave, you can game the system to some extent. You can twist it to suit you to some extent, to maximise your independence and your work-life balance. And the bosses would love to put a stop to that with all their control freakery, their addiction to ritual and precedent. This is why the government is giving the civil service such a hard time. This is why banks are blaming bank workers. people are being encouraged to blame home workers for every little thing that goes wrong, every shortage, every late bus. Workers are now being encouraged to go, oh, it's because of all these lazy bastards working from home. That's why I didn't get this in time. That's why this delivery was late, etc., etc. So workers should fight for this if they want it, because, you know, we're not going to get a revolution until workers are able to emancipate themselves from all the kind of rituals and the emotion that form the emotional and psychological fetters that capitalism puts on us, and, you know, and the fight to stay out of the office and, you know, if necessary, work all day in your bathrobe or your underwear. If that's what workers want, they should fight for that, because it's part of that necessary emancipation. And the biggest revolutions inevitably always start with the smallest of revolts. So there, that's all I've got to say on that subject. So over to you.